So let's get going on the session for today. There's a lot to talk about, and I do want us to do a series of exercises, short exercises, of course, and I'm sure we won't be able to get as far into that as in theory I would like, but let's see how far we can go. Let me make a couple of logistical points. This program ends next week, and then the next one is scheduled to start on April 14th. But as it turns out, I have another commitment on April 14th. I'll be traveling. So I would like to reschedule the start of that for April 21st, and I will mention that in the orientation materials, but I want people to start to think about that. The other practical matter is we have established this pattern now of having a practice day that, in theory at least, it helps round up what we've been doing during the program, and in a way it prepares people to go ahead. So it's a transition. So given that I will be traveling on April 14th, I think I'd like to do it on April 7th. So it would be April 7th at the same time that we would come together. And the purpose of that meeting, of course, is more for people to share their experience. We can do some practice too. But you know, I've been very pleased to see that on the website, the discussion has been fairly active this quarter. And I hope that would continue into the practice day. But we'll talk about that next week. Right now, I just wanted to set the date. So practice day, April 7th, and then the next program doesn't actually start until April 21st, which is a change from what's announced, and I guess we'll change that on the website also. Okay, so let's start. And I want to start with the reading from Knowledge of Time and Space. Does anybody want to say anything? Most of you or many of you are muted. But feel free to unmute or write a chat. You know, we've been reading so long now from Dynamics that it might be a little bit of a surprise to go into a different book. Anybody have any comments on that? No? Well, I'll say one thing about it anyway. And that is that I think that the material in Knowledge of Time and Space in general is very dense. I don't really mean that in the way that the reading itself uses the word dense when it's referring to space. I just mean there's a lot in there. And, you know, of course, that's true in Dynamics. And as Michael pointed out in one of his posts online, the way that we've been working for a while now in these sessions and the way that I've found comfortable, not so much comfortable, it just seems to me the best way to work, is to read very carefully, you know, read just a few pages each week and really excavate what's going on. And I think the text really rewards that because there's so much in it. I'm talking about Dynamics now. But Knowledge of Time and Space, I think, is even more, there's even more in it. And maybe I see it that way partly because, as I think I've mentioned before, I was the editor for Knowledge of Time and Space and for Dynamics for that matter. But Knowledge of Time and Space, the starting point for that book was to take all the material, this is a kind of a self-centered way of describing it, but the book before that, before Knowledge of Time and Space, was Love of Knowledge. And when that book was ready, there was a whole lot of notes that I had from Rinpoche that I just didn't understand. And he said, well, set them aside and we'll work with them later. And that was the genesis then a couple of years later for Knowledge of Time and Space, together with a lot of other materials. So from the very beginning, it was material that seemed, to me at least, difficult. Difficult is not a nice word. Maybe challenging is better to work with. So I say all that just because I think there's a tremendous amount going on just in these couple of pages, and you'll notice that these pages are toward the beginning of the book. And so, you know, some of what I say here is kind of building on what's in the text, but I thought it was valuable to assign it in the context here because we've been going a little bit in our own direction in terms of this question of the aliveness of time. And so the issue that I raised in the orientation for this week, where I wrote a kind of an independent short essay, the question that I raised is it possible to use the intensity of our ordinary experience, which we might want to say that's not really based on the aliveness of time, and yet it has its own aliveness. So the question is, what's the connection between those two? And this reading from Knowledge of Time and Space addresses that question. So I do think that when you start the reading from Knowledge of Time and Space, the first paragraph, I think you'll see that we're in the same arena. You know, it's the same author and the same vision. Let's see, I have a question here from Brigitte. It's said here privately. Okay. Kathleen, could you make a note of that? I'm not going to go into it since she's asking for a copy of something. Could you make a note, or I'll save the, well, I could just make a note and let me know later. I'll assume you can do that, unless I hear otherwise. The first paragraph we were talking about of this reading is about these two different ways of approaching time, and the fact that when we get caught up in linear temporality, we are losing contact with the aliveness of time in terms, you know, in favor of a world of positions, as it says here. We lose the creative energy of time. And then the reading goes on and talks about the bystander. And roughly speaking, for our purposes, we can say that the bystander is the same as the witness. That's not exactly true. But the point here is that somebody is taking a position and setting up a structure on the basis of that. And then there's a very interesting and important point made here. It comes up from time to time in the TSK books, but I think it's especially clear here. It's that once you have a bystander, once you have a witness, once through either of those approaches, once the self is set up, then what happens to, let's say, the aliveness of time and the presentation, the presenting of the flow of time, is that it gets turned into something very concrete, which is the experience of a self. And we might well say, well, of course, you know, that's what is at the center that's what I know about, is my experience. I can't know anything else. And that point gets made in Western philosophy, certain branches of Western philosophy and elsewhere. We have to start from our own experience. But there's a very important point here. This is one of these things that you would have to unpack. And that is that experience is not in itself the final word. You know, experience is already something that belongs to a self. So when I look at my own experience, and we really can't avoid talking that way, if we do these exercises and we say, you know, see what's happening in your own experience or something like that. We just very, very naturally talk that way. Michael raises a question here, and I will address it in a moment, but let me finish with this thought. So this experience is at the center of the self, of the structure that the witness or the bystander sets up. And then, you know, the point is made in the next paragraph, the third paragraph in the reading, just as substance at the center makes space dense. And that is a whole other topic we won't go into. So experience at the center makes time tense. And of course, this word tense, is a play on words, right? Because we talk about time having the past, present, and future tense. So when you put experience at the center, that means you're committing yourself to a past, present, future structure. But the word also means creating a tension. Our experience, it has a built-in tension to it, a built-in discomfort to it. I looked at those, at the word tense. Those are two different origins. You know, when we talk about the present tense of time, the origin of that word tense is actually the Latin word for time. It just means time. And originally, in fact, the earliest use of the word tense in that sense in English was as a synonym for time. The other form of tense comes from a different source. It has to do with stretching, with reaching out to grasp something, you could say. But even those two, although they're very different from each other, are connected to each other, because when time gets, you know, when we have a past, present, and future, time gets stretched out. It's tense in that sense too. And then there's this underlying sense of discomfort, the tension that we feel when we live in that kind of time. Now, Michael's question was, what I've said from time to time and just said again about, you know, the editorial process of working with Rinpoche's notes and going back over the material, and the question is, how do you, why doesn't that mean that the material turns into a past-centered experience? Because I'm looking at notes that, based on meetings in the past. How do we return to the aliveness? And I don't want to say too much about that, but what I can say is that that is exactly what happens. You start with something, and I think this is probably true for this kind of writing in general, but especially for the writing with the TSK material, you start with your notes and you're going back and trying to kind of reconstruct something. So you're very much in the past. But as you work with the material and go back into it, and you do have the immediacy in your mind of the experience of Rinpoche presenting the material, it comes alive again. It reawakens. I think that's all I can say about it. And in fact, that's when you know that you kind of, when you have a good clue that you've got it right, you know, that you're going in a good direction. When you kind of find yourself engaged in the aliveness of the material. And it does even sometimes happen that when you're working with the material, speaking now as the editor, when you're working with the material, editing it, in some ways, it can become more alive because you begin to understand it at a deeper level than you did when you were just absorbing what Rinpoche is saying. It's like, you know, sometimes you just are kind of taking notes, making sure you don't lose anything, trying to make sure, but you just don't understand it. And it's when you go back over it that it comes alive. So it's an interesting question. I don't think I want to say more than that, though. Okay, so we were talking about the tenseness of experience. So the self is the one that experiences. The very nature of experience leads to a tension. And, you know, if you ask why, I think one thing to say, and again, I'm kind of digging into what it says here in this reading, it doesn't make it specific. But the tenseness of time is because we're trying to set up a structure and impose it. You know, it's hard work. I suppose you could say it's a little like the tension of the body, which is natural when it's just trying to hold itself upright. You know, it's harder than that because, you know, you're trying to manufacture something out of nothing in a sense, or you're trying to impose this additional layer on the aliveness of time. It's just really, you know, we don't recognize it because this is how we live, but it's just really hard work. And it's not just that it's hard, but that we're trying to create something that really has no foundation. So, you know, it's as though you were, as though you were trying to hold some position, a physical position, that is awkward and unnatural. And it just wears you out. Whereas you were kind of letting gravity take its course, that would be much more natural. So there's that tension. The self is trying to establish its experience as real and as solid. And, you know, it tries to convince itself, and it does convince itself, that that's working. But in fact, it's not working. You know, it's not really. Experience is not really like that. So that's the tenseness. It's a kind of an intensity, as Rinpoche says in this same paragraph. He calls it a constricting intensity that allows for no alternatives. And I think a good phrase to think of there, one that we've talked about in the program, is it's single-minded. You know, it's a constricting intensity with no alternatives. Intensity in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. Engaging in something intensely. Again, if it's kind of in harmony with the flow of time, that may be very positive. But here he's talking about a single-minded intensity where we're trying to establish what he refers to as restriction and necessity. Right? That's where we run into trouble. The self is trying to kind of take control of time, create a position in time, and as a result, it's not really able to participate in time. Now all of that is, we've already discussed very similar themes in the reading so far. And in these couple of paragraphs, I think we get a little bit different orientation on it, but it's something we've already looked at. But the reason that I wanted to assign this reading is that in the rest of the reading, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but in the rest of the reading, the point is made that intensity does have its own energy, and it builds up into what is described here mostly as a kind of emotionality. Right? Let's maybe look five paragraphs down, the paragraph that starts, when involvement grows this intense, it feeds back into the frozen momentum of first-level time, creating an imbalance that begins to affect the structural integrity of the temporal order. See, now all of that we really have to investigate. That's what I mean when I say this book is very rich. You really have to go into it. But we can kind of get a sense, and that's all we can do right now. So what happens is that intensity in itself, it's not the aliveness of time, but it is its own aliveness. And you could say that it's borrowing the aliveness of time. It's kind of taking it in a distorted way to try to build up its own structure. That's what's being talked about here. And that's the part that is a little different from what's in the reading and that I thought was actually very helpful to work with. So there is a tenseness which leads to an intensity, and that intensity has its own aliveness, and through it we develop emotionality. You know, so it says at the end of that paragraph, If the initial response has been, I am angry, well, let's see, maybe I should go back a little. Pressure builds up, becoming destabilizing, even painful. Identification grows more complete. And then, so the initial reaction of I am angry becomes stronger. The self becomes its anger. And if there's complete identification, I am angry is transformed into I hate, and energy spills over into action. So the idea here is, or the theme that I want to have us explore is that there is a kind of an aliveness in our experience. You know, it's one thing to say we trade the aliveness of time. You remember that quote we've been working with on page 90, I think it is, of Dynamics. It says in this battle between past-centered time and future-centered time, we're asking whether we're truly alive. But that makes it sound like the distinction or the two possibilities are, on the one hand, we're alive, and on the other hand, we're dead. And in fact, people sometimes think that way. You know, let's say sometimes people make that charge about science, for instance, that it's a kind of a dead hand, a dead, you know, it's like not letting the butterfly fly free, but pinning it down, literally, you know, pinning it into your collection. So everything, you lose the aliveness. And that's true. That's, you know, that is a point that Rinpoche makes. But here he's also saying, well, you can't just imagine that everything is frozen and dead in that sense, because there is a kind of distorted aliveness that shows up in things like emotionality. That's what I want to explore. How could we look into the aliveness of what's happening right now? So even if we are going about our experience, and that experience is mostly given form by our emotional reactions, our, you know, our liking and disliking, our wanting and rejecting, the kinds of things that get talked about in Buddhism all the time, the kind of fundamentally distorted ways of using the mind, greed, hatred, delusion. Even if that's what's going on, there's an aliveness there. It's a distorted aliveness, but it's an aliveness. And the question is, could we work with that? Because, you know, if we can't, then we have a little bit of a problem. The problem is that we have to, if we want to explore what it's like to be in touch with the aliveness of time, we have to first find a way to shift away from our usual way of being and enter a more positive, a more inherently dynamic and alive way of being. And that's, of course, very nice and a good way to practice. But a lot of the time we operate in this more distorted, more frozen, more past-centered and position-taking way of living. And so the question arises, could we find the aliveness within that? It seems like that would be very helpful. And there's all sorts of ways in which we ordinarily engage the world which might have that aliveness within them. One place to look, for instance, and in a moment I'm going to introduce several and have us at least explore a couple of them. But one place to look is just the way that experience keeps moving on. You know, that's just part of our experience. And again, now, when we use the word experience, we should be hearing in that the fact that we're already committed, when we're talking about experience, we're already committed to a structure in which the self has taken up the position at the center. So we're looking at our experience, and one of the things we can say about our experience One of the things we can say about that experience is that it keeps going. You know, the next thing comes up, and the next thing comes up, and the next thing comes up, and that in itself is a kind of an aliveness. And we actually looked at that in terms of the readings from Dynamics, where in going to the point where the next moment arises, that's a way of engaging that aliveness. We could also look just in terms of the kind of restless quality, which is a little different. That's going more toward the emotionally driven way of experiencing. The mind has this innate restlessness. Now, there's a little discussion going on over here in the chat room, so let me take a look at what's being said. So David says, is it fair, I assume, is it fair to compare emotionality as the lava that comes from the source of the volcano where the aliveness of time resides? Yeah, I think that's right. If that image, a couple of people have referred to that image, so I'm glad it's helpful. The aliveness is coming from the center and you know, the source of the volcano, let's say, from, you know, bubbling up from the earth, these deep forces. Then you could say emotionality was the lava. But, you know, what happens is it kind of freezes, right? That's the thing about lava, is it leaves the volcano, it turns into something frozen, but not before it's created this kind of ugly mess. That ugly mess is the emotional world we live in, right? It kind of takes everything in its path before it. Brigitte says something, but Caroline responds to David's question that in the lava there's an intrinsic aliveness. It's bright, it's hot, it's moving. Yes, and so either we want to say, well, maybe the image isn't completely accurate, or we could say that is kind of what we're trying to find is this, you know, we're extruding this emotionality, but within it there is an aliveness. It's bright, it's hot, it's moving. That's right. So Brigitte says the distortion element isn't in this image. I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, Brigitte, or saying. You mean in the image of the lava? I'll let you comment on that. But in the meantime, or Brigitte, do you want to say something? I see you're actually set up to speak. Yes? I don't hear you. Oh, now you're muted. Well, I'm going to move on because I want to do a couple of other things. But if you want to reframe that question, I just didn't quite understand what you were saying. So, okay. We want to go to what's alive. We end up doing it in going, you know, in this sort of, you know, in this world that we've set up, and that which is not the real aliveness. And that's one reason why we're restless. We're never satisfied. We try to find something alive, but it's just, you know, we're only looking in the world that we find, which is a kind of a, you know, lip sync version, as I said last week, of the reality that we're in. So what I would like to explore, and I think what I'll do is put some of this in the orientation for the next class, because we're not going to be able to deal with all of it. But there's many possible places that you could look for that aliveness, even within the realm of what is artificial, distorted in the sense of you know, we've taken some strange position that leaves us totally out of balance and so on. And a shorthand for that is emotionality. Even though that's what's going on, there you could look for the aliveness within it. And so I wanted to check or have us work with at least a couple of possibilities, and I'll say something about them as we go into it. So the first one is the quality of emotionality or concern. So, you know, people are very different. And of course your experience changes from moment to moment, or at least, you know, even on the most obvious level from hour to hour, let's say, Okay. So Brigitte is saying, I thought that's what you probably meant. So Brigitte comments, the lava flowing is a natural flow, not a distorted movement. Well, the reason I introduced the image of the lava originally was to say that the source of the aliveness was at the origin, you know, and by the not at the tongue of the lava, not at the place where it's where we are actually engaging in experience. So yeah, I think to make the distinction between you know, distorted and natural isn't going to work so well with that particular image. So I'm going to drop that image for now. So I was saying, one place to look for aliveness is in emotionality. And I'm starting to say that, you know, sometimes we feel emotional, sometimes we feel pretty much relaxed and at peace. And so you won't always find a point of emotionality to work with. But for some people, you know, there's always a kind of an undertone of maybe it's emotionality, maybe it's concern. I think concern, it has an emotional dimension, but sometimes people think of it as something different, where there's just something you're that's on your mind. You know, you're wondering if something's going the right way, or you're worried. But it really, maybe it doesn't matter too much to make that distinction. Emotionality, worry, fear, anticipation, excitement, all of those things that are just a natural part of our experience, that's one place to look for aliveness. And it's an easy place in the sense it has an aliveness. The word emotion means moving out, right? And so there's a movement built into the idea of emotion. So I think what I'd like to have us do is take a couple of minutes, look for the quality of emotion or concern in your experience right now. If it's not there, then just look for aliveness wherever it might be. But if it is there, the distinction here, the point of to practice with, to investigate, would be to say, well, can I go to the aliveness of the emotion or the fear or the concern or the excitement, and let go of the characterization of it as being a particular emotion or being positive or negative or so on. So that's the practice. Let's try that for a couple of minutes, and then maybe we'll have time to look in one other place for that possibility. Okay, a couple of minutes. I'm going to shut off the video as a clue. Okay. So I will give people a chance to comment, and we can maybe talk about it. So you can comment verbally or, of course, via the chat. As I said, the thing about emotionality is that there's clearly a kind of an aliveness to it. And what we're looking for is, can we take that aliveness and turn it in the direction of that is more true, a direction that is more true to time's intrinsic, always arising capacity? Because usually emotions are based on looking back at something. You know? They're based on, I mean, even if you're looking into the future, but there's a structure that you're connecting the reaction to. You're worried about something that's going to happen. Well, you know, all sorts of structures have been built up. The underlying aliveness is something more unstructured. You know, it has never taken form. That's really what we've been exploring. So David writes something about this: the emotion of anxious concern over possible events that could unfold. If I let go of the structural conducting, I feel a space of feeling that moves and evolves. Okay, well, that raises exactly, it seems to me, the right question, which is, how could you tell? You know, what's the difference between a kind of distorted, let's drop the word distorted, the kind of single-minded intensity that Rinpoche describes in the reading from Knowledge of Time and Space, and he describes that very much as heading towards emotionality because we identify. So how do you distinguish that from tuning in more to the aliveness, the inherent dynamic and aliveness of time? And one place to look, one way to do that, I think, is exactly what David said here. He says, if I let go of the structural conducting, I feel a space of feeling that moves and evolves. So when emotion turns more, you could say, in the direction of feeling, it seems likely that that's going to be more closely related to the dynamic aliveness of time. Now, we could go further with feeling also, we're not going to try to do that right now. Let's see. Karen has posted something. She says, emotion goes along with a strong momentum. The aliveness is somehow channeled, staying with it without getting involved. Yeah, so I think, if I understand correctly, that's really basically what we're suggesting as a possibility here, that you can stay with the aliveness. And if I understand you correctly, you know, in the emotion, a momentum comes up. There's a structure that's been established, and you're headed very strongly in that direction, and it has to do with identification, you know, and the possibility of a very strong identification where you become the emotion, or it might not be that strong. That's what Rinpoche talks about in Knowledge of Time and Space. So the alternative then would be to stay with the feeling, but not go along with the momentum that is channeling it in a certain direction and a certain identity and a certain structure. And presumably, if you do that, and this is something to explore, presumably if you do that, then the channeling changes. The momentum dissolves. It's I guess the image would be, you've got this river, this powerful river that's running into the ocean, but then when it's in the ocean, you know, that momentum, that forward thrust, changes into something very different. So that's a possibility. I hear someone typing here. Ah, yes, Brigitte, okay. All weekend, I was sitting over my tax papers, 2 years, or 2 years worth of taxes, I guess. I got so emotional over all these hours. I felt tortured, squeezed, imprisoned in my home in numbers, trying to reconstruct my life in terms of income and expenses. In my stomach and chest, all the energy had become dense. When I did the practice, those energy centers started to loosen and stopped building up and up, and a sense of humor came, aliveness, vast. Well, it's a very nice description. I'm not going to add to that at all. I think that really is exactly the kind of thing that we're exploring. So, thank you. Okay, so another possibility, which we won't go into, is that feelings themselves, if you know, and this is kind of, for those of you who are familiar with Kumye, this is going to sound very familiar now, what I'm saying. If you go directly to a feeling, it may be linked in some subtle way to a kind of an emotionality, or it may be channeled. But if you go into the feeling, then it can open up in new ways. And that sense of the self directing it, the bystander, the witness testifying to it, all of those structures that get imposed can shift, can move away. And that's a possibility. We're not going to go into that. I wanted to try one more, although we hardly have any time. But let me at least suggest it. And that is, in fact, I think we won't even try to do it. I'm sorry, we just don't have time. But I will go into this in the orientation. I will suggest some possibilities that you could work with during the coming week. And I'd be very interested to have you share on the website how that goes for you, because there's so many different ways, so many different possibilities for taking the aliveness of time and channeling it. But the one that we'll start with, that we've already kind of talked about, is the aliveness in thoughts and images and stories. You know, the narrative thrust, for one thing, the going forward, and actually what Brigitte mentioned is a great, or described as a great example of that. Let's see what Michael says, and then we'll probably stop. I'll mention one more thing. So Michael writes, exploring anxiety for my sense of not being able to prepare my sons for the future, to teach them useful skills. I find myself yearning for more knowledge and the ability to harness it. Yet the sense of not having access to the knowledge I wish I had doesn't in itself help me much. Okay, well, that's a very real example you're bringing, both of you, actually, Brigitte and Michael. I appreciate that very much. These are the kinds of ways in which these issues come up in our lives. You know, I think to give a very short kind of TSK-flavored response to that is that when you are working on the basis of anxiety and of not knowing what you need to know, that puts the knowledge out somewhere else in the future. That reinforces the past, present, future structure in which whatever you need isn't there, isn't available. What these teachings, what these readings have been suggesting is that there's a different kind of knowledge, a different kind of knowing available. And that's what we're interested in investigating. I started to say that's what we're looking for, but that's probably the wrong way to say it for obvious reasons. You know, we're investigating the possibility that the knowledge we need is available and inseparable from the aliveness of time. Obviously, it doesn't mean that we know all the facts that we need to know, but there may be a deeper knowing we're talking about. Okay, well, the one practical thing, again, that I wanted to mention, and this will be in the orientation too, of course, is there is a section in Dynamics of Time and Space which does explore some of these questions, some of the questions that we raised by looking at the reading from Knowledge of Time and Space and that we've been exploring today. And that is chapter 30. And it starts, I think, on page 295 or so, thereabouts, in the English. And it's called Healing Time. And so I'm going to suggest that that you look that over. And there's an exercise, chapter 30, the first few pages lead to an exercise, exercise 13. I don't remember what it's called, but you might try working with the first part of exercise 13. There's two parts, so you might try working with that. Okay, so that's where we stand for this week. Next week will be our last class in this session, but I think one of the things about the way it's been going this in this program in this winter is that a lot of possibilities for working with the material have presented themselves. So I think that you'll be able to keep going on your own very nicely in the next few weeks. Okay, see you next week then.